The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
One of the country's best-known A&E consultants and recently retired emergency physician has returned to the front line. Adjunct Senior Lecturer in Public Health in UCC, Chris Luke, is on the line. Good morning, Chris. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. So what's it like being back on the front line?
Well, I have to say, first and foremost, it's an absolute delight. At the moment, I'm back in the Mercy because when I put my hands up to volunteer, the Mercy were on the phone to me. And so I elected to go back there. I mean, I have spent the last 20 years working mostly in the Mercy and CUH. But at the moment, I'm just in the Mercy. And of course, I'm flexible, but it's a joy. And I mean, I know so many of the people in the staff. And there's been a lovely warm welcome, which has been absolutely, you know, really heartening.
Did you have any qualms personally about it? I mean, the reason I ask that question is because you and I are of the same generation and, you know, we're approaching the sort of the danger zone, so to speak.
Yeah, you know, I'm well into the danger zone. I mean, I'm in my 60s. I have a number of issues. You know, I've had coronary stents. I've had surgery and I've had, you know, various other things going on. But no, I don't. I tell you, first of all, I actually love emergency medicine. I'm one of those very strange doctors who have a very short attention span and who revel in the excitement and diversity of the emergency department, where we see so many different things. We hopefully fix as many things as we can. We find solutions, and we control crowds. So I always remind people that our parents were military medicine and missionary medicine. So I like to think that we're very well placed at the present time in terms of, you know, dealing with the expected surge. But no, I have to say, Mark, to be absolutely honest with you, I suppose I console myself with the fact that this is mostly a terrible condition, but which mostly affects those who are of a certain age. And I, as a father of four children and so forth, I think that the young people will be okay. And that's why I'm relatively okay.
I didn't for one second think that you would have any qualms about it. I'd say that we're probably trying to hold you back. But how did the family feel about it? Did they have any qualms?
Well, I mean, my daughter Kira is actually another emergency physician. She's an A&E doctor in Dublin in the Mater, and I suppose a shout out to them. They're the wonderful team in the Mater, and of course all our friends all around the 28, 30 odd departments in the country. And you know, it was a moment's trepidation, I suppose. But no, I mean, they understood that I wouldn't be held back.
Okay. Once you got in there, what was it like? Was it, you know, familiar surroundings? It's like a really, 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 really awful Saturday night, or a month of Saturday nights, or was it? Were you
the opposite? Well,
yeah, I was going to say, were you prepared for what you were facing?
Well, no, because I actually helped to design the department in the Mercy about 15 years ago, and it's an absolutely beautiful department. It's just there on the river there in the city centre, just below the cathedral. The old mansion, the Mercy is the old mansion house, and we're in the new building opposite it. But so it's a beautifully located department looking up the river, and there's trees in the opposite bank, so that's very nice. The department itself was the footprint of the old car park, and we were given the opportunity around about 2003-04 to design a department, which we did. You know, the nursing, medical, and hospital staff designed it. And, you know, it's a lovely department. The only problem, of course, is like every other department, it's a question of capacity. But in preparation for the expected onslaught, we have put walls and window doors where previously there were curtains. We're now back to single occupancy cubicles. There's a huge amount of streamlining and acquisition of other spaces in the adjacent buildings. We've got military tents put up there yesterday with a really wonderful efficiency by the Army. And I've suggested that we keep the military police in order to keep the traffic flowing around the hospital for the future. But, you know, obviously it's been very quiet because many people have been staying away from the hospitals. And that's given us the opportunity to simulate, to rehearse, to war game, you know, the sort of resuscitations and treatments that we will be looking at. There's a huge amount of information coming at us from all angles, from specialists, you know, respiratory intensive care people, from emergency department, emergency medicine groups nationally and locally, and there's a huge amount of preparation going on within the hospital in terms of, I suppose, focus groups, workshops, lectures, and preparation within the department.
Yeah, in terms of the surge that we're expecting in the coming days and weeks, do you think you're as well prepared as you possibly can be?
I think we are. I mean, as possibly as we can be. You know, there's a limit to what people can learn or can do in within a couple of weeks. People are, I suppose, as well briefed. We have the kit at the moment. I suppose the obvious anxiety is the situation in Italy and New York running out of kit. But at the moment, you know, I have every faith. I think our team at the top are playing a blinder. I mean, the danger, I suppose, is complacency. And, you know, people keep saying, oh, you're doing really, really well. The chief medical officer, the chief clinical officer, who, of course, is a physician from the Mercy and a great friend and comrade, Colm Henry. I think, you know, they're playing a blinder. But I think it's a bit like being 3 points up against the All Blacks in the first 15 minutes. You know, there's a long way to go against one of the greatest threats, or one of the toughest opponents we've ever faced. So, you know, I think the greatest hazard is complacency. This idea that, oh, yeah, we've definitely flattened the curve. We haven't definitely done anything. You know, we won't know for months or even years whether we were successful or relatively how successful we were. So my greatest concern is that we become a little bit too cocky or too complacent.
Yeah, what do you make
we expect a surge.
Yeah, what do you make of the latest figures? I mean, it's currently 98 dead, 402 new cases yesterday, 3,849 confirmed cases. I was looking at some numbers somewhere else yesterday, and it said that if you were to compare us to, say, for example, Italy or Spain, that on a pro rata basis, if we were following them, then we should have exceeded 1,000 deaths at this stage. Now, 98 dead is 98 too many, obviously, but that would seem to the layman like myself that we're doing pretty well. Or is it just this is actually the lull before the real storm?
There's no doubt that this is the calm before the storm. There's no doubt. I agree with you. There is cause for some incredibly cautious optimism. But as I say, we're just 3 points up against the All Blacks. So, or, you know, we've had an extraordinarily astonishing lucky goal against the Germans or the Dutch, you know. So, look, we really have got to be very, very vigilant. I mean, you know the old expression, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. We have got to be incredibly vigilant for the next 4 to 6 weeks. And if anything, our going out and comings and going should be reduced even further. That's what I would say, because if they've done this so far with the sort of 80% lockdown we've had, well, then maybe we should only be going out in one.
That was going to be my next question to you. Do you expect the current restrictions to be extended beyond Easter Sunday? And if you were asked by NFET or by the Taoiseach or whoever is in charge of these things, what's your advice on it? What would it be?
Well, I mean, reading all the stuff from the WHO and from the Asian countries, and even people like the Slovakian Republic and the Czech Republic about like masks in public, and I see that the WHO are just teetering the brink of making them recommending them for everybody in public, and I think that's probably the next stage. But only homemade masks, you know, cloth washable masks that we put on and take off every day. We wash and put on afresh the next day. Absolutely not surgical masks, because they are going to be incredibly precious for our staff. And the main reason for not wearing masks in public is because there aren't enough of them for the staff. And that's I put that at the fore of any answer. Should we wear cloth masks as they do in China or elsewhere? Yes. Probably over the coming week or so. Should we tighten the restrictions? I don't know. I'll wait to hear. I mean, I'll be absolutely guided by the National Public Health Emergency Team. I think they've played an inspiring game so far. Just we have to be very, very cautious, because the enemy can strike any minute. And I mean, my heart sank when I heard that the chief medical officer had been taken to hospital, I must say, you know, because I'd already said, you know, we're 3 points up and all we need now is to lose one of our top players, or for the weather to change, you know, or for one of their guys to come off, one of their stars to come off the bench.
Yeah.
Well, so we have to be very, very vigilant. And I think perhaps the next stage might be just people just going out in ones. I mean, that's an obvious idea. But again, as I say, I'll wait to be told.
Well, it has to be said that Tony Houlihan was not in hospital for anything to do with COVID. He had some tests. He's back in the saddle yesterday. Interestingly, he did talk in as part of the press conference last night or yesterday. He talked about when he was in James's, and that he had a concern that people were not actually attending their doctors and hospitals when they needed to. He said there were, you know, empty waiting rooms, etc., etc. Everybody was geared up for COVID. But, and it's something I'll be talking to other doctors about during the course of the programme, all the other things that hospitals do and deal with haven't gone away, you know, they haven't vanished. But have you found that there's been a drop off in other areas of hospital activity?
Massive. And that's why the departments in COH and the Mercy have been relatively quiet for the last week or so. And on the one hand, that's been extremely, it's been a blessing because we've been able to get on with the training of the staff and the enormous reconfiguration. I mean, there's ventilators everywhere you look in COH. There are, negative pressure rooms everywhere. There's a lot going on to prepare for the onslaught. I suppose my concern is that we may get a twin onslaught of the normal workload, that has been a delayed presentation of a surge of people who've kept their diseases at home, the strokes, the hearts, the heart arrhythmias, the lung issues and so on, and that they will suddenly present at the same time as the COVID, and that's obviously a major concern. I'm not quite sure how you deal with that, but I would just hope that people do realise that the reason to go to hospital is for very sick, if you're very sick for whatever reason. And if you're very sick, you shouldn't be at home. And conversely, if you're not very sick, you should be at home, whether you have COVID or not. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That if you have COVID-19 and you have very, very mild symptoms, you will be sent home. You will be treated at home and you will be asked to stay at home, even if you go to hospital. Conversely, we'd like people to come to hospital as soon as possible if they are very ill.
Okay. Dr. Chris Luke, listen, thank you for your service. We wish you all the very best. Stay safe and well. Now, we'll move to another eminent physician, Professor John Crone, consultant oncologist in St. Vincent University Hospital. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mark.
Even though life has changed out of all recognition because of COVID-19, life also goes on. And as I was talking with Chris there, people are still going to get sick with all the things that had our health service under so much pressure before, rates of cancer, heart disease, kidney, liver, lungs, etc. They haven't vanished. So how are you? How is the system coping with that, in as far as you can tell?
Well, Mark, the COVID crisis has had a huge impact on cancer care and for several reasons. Obviously, there is the fact that cancer patients and the treatments we give cancer patients place them at a somewhat higher vulnerability to getting a more severe form of COVID infection. Quite a few studies now at this stage from the early days of the epidemic, mostly in China, also some data from Europe, suggest that if you get COVID infection and you are a cancer patient, it is more likely, it is not inevitable, by the way, it is more likely that you will get the severe variety, and unfortunately it is more likely that you will die. Most cancer patients who get COVID infection survive the infection. Cancer patients need to understand that. Most cancer patients who get it will survive the infection. The risk is higher, and I think our need to protect them is greater. So cancer patients, their carers, those who live with them, I think need to be extra careful about the physical isolation. I don't like the word social isolation, but the physical isolation that we are really asking them to live by.
Anybody who comes down with COVID is going to get sick. It's going to be short, hard, intense. When I say short, I'm talking about a week, 2 weeks, maybe three at most. And as you said, vast majority of people will recover. Anybody who's undergoing cancer treatment is on ongoing, pretty intensive treatment over months, not weeks. Has the services for cancer patients been impacted dramatically in that regard?
Yes, and there are several aspects to this. In the first instance, most of the guidelines now suggest that if a patient is on cancer treatment and they get COVID infection, the treatment really should be suspended, if at all possible, until the infection is cleared, not to be continuing with chemotherapy or radiotherapy or any other potentially troublesome cancer treatments in patients who have an active COVID infection. And the other issue, of course, is that even if the treatments that we give, and in many cases this is true, many of the treatments we give are not particularly, I have to be careful how I use the word toxic. They don't produce side effects or dangerous side effects compared to some other cancer treatments, which can produce dangerous side effects. Even if the treatment is quite a mild treatment, if the treatment necessitates you getting out of your cocoon of isolation at home, traveling with one or more family members, possibly on some kind of public transport, coming into a hospital, interacting with lots of other people, there is a clear increase in risk purely due to the fact that you've had to break your own isolation. So we and all of my colleagues around the country have been putting together new programs for the treatment of our cancer patients, taking this increased risk, not a risk from the treatment itself in some cases, but a risk from traveling to get the treatment, from being in the hospital, from breaking your own isolation. We're factoring this in and trying to make the treatments less visit intense. Treatments which might have brought you in, we'll say, every week. We're trying to see where, if at all possible, if we can drop them down to every 2 weeks or every 3 weeks. If it's possible in some cases to switch to tablet treatments, we're trying to do that.
Has there been a reluctance to attend, John?
I've had some patients who, after we put in all of these new strictures and all of these guidelines, we reckon that perhaps they should come in, and patients have voluntarily said, is it okay if I don't? And in most cases, I've said, yes, it is. There are a few situations where we can't actually, you know, delay things a few weeks until the real, you know, push of the surge, if it happens, and please God, hopefully it does not. But if that surge happens, if we get through that, hopefully things will be under better control in a few weeks or a month's time.
Okay. With everything that's going on, and look, we've geared up about as well as we possibly can. Are there still things that you're concerned about? And what are they, and what are you most concerned about?
Masks. I think all healthcare workers should be wearing masks. And I freely admit there are experts in the field of microbiology and infectious diseases who disagree with this. But if you look internationally, there is a real momentum change on this. My own belief is that in the hospital, all healthcare workers interacting with one another and with patients need to wear masks. It is, and I completely accept this, it is well proven that masks give poor protection against virus infection in many settings. The main benefit of masks is felt to be reducing the chance that the person who is wearing the mask will give the infection to someone else. And in the hospital healthcare setting, this is critical because we have about 25%, if I've seen the most recent figures, of Irish COVID-infected patients are healthcare workers. And already some units are losing staff at an unacceptable rate. Now, thankfully, you know, most of these staff will get better. Sadly, this is not always the case. But we can't afford to lose healthcare workers. And critically, Mark, we can't afford for healthcare workers to be infecting patients. If you go around the streets of Dublin, as I did this morning, walking into work as I'm doing, I didn't hardly encounter another person. I saw multiple buses going into town that are empty. Offices are empty. Factories are shutting down. We really have achieved an extreme degree of physical isolation, except in one workplace. And that's the hospital. So I think it is proportionately more important at this stage that we now focus on decreasing in-hospital infection, both of staff and of patients. And to me, it's simple. I do understand there is a shortage of masks, and in particular, there is a shortage of the highest grade of mask, which is the best at decreasing viral transmission. But I think the evidence is pretty clear that a person who is wearing a mask is a little less likely to give the infection to the person beside them. And if both parties are wearing a mask, it probably will have a significant impact. Everyone in the hospital will.
Yeah, you've probably seen this morning or last night that the CDC in the States has now recommended that everybody should be wearing masks, not just people in hospitals. And it's ironic, actually, because Trump, and I don't really want to give him credit for anything, was saying that, you know, even wearing a scarf or something like that, I think he said it last week and people were laughing at him, but he said even something like that would help. They've now come out with this. The WHO, I believe, are probably going to endorse that today. But that brings me to the question about the messaging and about the way it can change. Look, I know the old Keynesian thing of, you know, when I get new information, I change my opinion. Are you finding, as a medical professional, that best practice and what you should be doing is changing on almost a daily basis?
It is, Mark.
And how is the messaging of that being dealt with, in your opinion?
I think the reason for that is simple. I mean, you know, this disease did not really exist, possibly in biology someplace, but it did not exist as a recognized human entity until, you know, December and January. So I think the strides that medicine and science have made with this, identifying the virus, identifying its structure, working hard on a vaccine, having multiple tests, working out how it's transmitted, I think there's been extraordinary. You know, my hat's off to the scientists who've done all the great work on this. And obviously the data will change. And I'm not going to point fingers at anybody who said last week, don't wear a mask, if this week they're saying, do wear a mask. You're right. Data changes. My opinions about lots of cancer treatments have changed as new information, new research becomes available. I think it's very important, you know, that we don't look back. We mightn't always have 100% agreed on the timing of every step we've taken, but all the steps I believe now are correct, and I completely support the government and the chief medical officer's attempts at physical distancing, all of the efforts we're making to get this disease under control, to chase the disease. I really do hope we make progress on the testing front. The testing has been disappointing, and again, I am not pointing a finger at anyone. The international environment for procuring all the chemicals that you need to do the test is very difficult and very competitive at this moment. In addition, you must understand that there wasn't really the kind of national infrastructure in place to deal with a huge, completely unanticipated pandemic. My word, Mark, this is only, what, April 3rd? I mean, if anybody had said to me on February 28th how the 1 month of March would unfold in Italy, Spain, France, in Ireland, the US and Canada and around the world, people would have been pinching themselves and saying that just seems very improbable. It has been an extraordinary month, a tragic month for so many people, a great challenge to medicine, a great challenge to science, a great challenge to our health services. We need to now just knuckle down for the next few weeks, and hopefully we'll see that we're getting on top of this thing and pushing it back.
Mm. In terms of other wider issues, like the testing backlog and protecting staff and patients, personal protection equipment and supplies and stuff like that, are you satisfied that in your hospital that ye are as good as ye can be, or ye are as up to speed as ye can be?
We're as up to speed as we can be in the environment we're in, with the availability of there is a worldwide shortage of personal protective equipment, and certainly the higher grades of personal protective equipment, there is a colossal worldwide shortage. It's not just Ireland. The United States probably has the most advanced, it's a health system that has problems, but it has in its hospital system clearly the most advanced hospital system in the world, the highest number of doctors, specialist beds, the best access to what are the latest tests, technology, etc. They are having a colossal shortage of personal protective equipment and of a high grade. One thing that I'm a little bit less happy about is when doctors and other health professionals point out that there are such shortages, I think they should be listened to. I think the attitude should not be you're taking off your green jersey and you're not playing with the team and you point this stuff out. Or the same thing is happening in Britain, in America, and around the world. I think it is important that when doctors and other health workers point out that there are deficiencies, they're continuing to work with the deficiencies. And, you know, Mark, it's not me. I'm thank God I'm not in the front firing lines of this thing. I'm looking after my cancer patients, but I'm not being called in. Several of which, by the way, have been infected and some of which have already recovered. But those young people, mostly, who are going in, putting themselves in harm's way every day, and will be doing so on a much larger scale over the next several weeks, if any of them do point out that there are deficiencies, I think what the appropriate official response should be, yes, we're terribly sorry there are those deficiencies. We acknowledge it. They are there. We really are trying to fix it. Thank you for pointing it out to us and to the public.
On that note, Professor John Crone, consultant oncologist in St. Vincent's University Hospital. Thank you very much indeed. John, God bless you. Stay well and be safe.